Okay, this is talking with Robert Price on 17th August 1981 at the IRSI meeting in Washington, D.C. Well, first of all, let me ask what your educational background was, and then how you first came into contact with radio astronomy.
Well, I got my bachelor's degree in physics at Princeton under Robert Dickey.
Mm-hmm.
I was very delighted to have him as my thesis advisor, and I built a new type of ionization chamber for my senior thesis, mm-hmm. which they have at Princeton. But I'd always determined to be an electrical engineer. I'd been advised that the best way to be a good one was to be a physicist first and then mm-hmm. transfer to electrical engineering. So after I got my bachelor's, I went to MIT.
Mm-hmm.
I had offers from MIT and Stanford, but I guess I didn't want to be too far away from my parents, so I went up to MIT. I never did get a master's degree. In those days, it was possible to go for the doctorate directly
right.
at MIT. And the field of statistical communication theory was really beginning to flower, and MIT was the world leader in mm-hmm. that field. Beginnings of it had been happening during World War II. Then some very good books were published by the Radiation Laboratory.
Right.
One book in particular called Threshold Signals.
Right.
And that sort of focused my decision on what I would specialize in.
Now, what years now are you talking about in graduate study at MIT?
I graduated in 1950, and in the fall of 1950, I went to MIT on a fellowship, an industrial fellowship, and I was privileged to have a year of courses. I didn't have to be a laboratory assistant
right.
or a teaching assistant. I was on a full-time fellowship, and one course in particular really greatly appealed to me, taught by Professor Wilbur Davenport. No books then existed, but later on he published the first book in the field on statistical communications. And I asked if I could work with him, and he was involved in a couple of research projects, and I was asked whether I preferred the classified or the unclassified project. And being curious, I elected the classified uh-huh. project. And this was at the very beginnings of a new technique called spread spectrum communications, in which the concept was to actually use noise in order to create secure communications by modulating the noise. It sounds crazy, but it worked, and I was involved doing that for my thesis.
Mm-hmm.
It was a high-frequency intercontinental communication system that involved the ionosphere. We knew that there would be problems in the correlation techniques.
When you say high frequency, you mean HF?
HF,
right,
yes,
yeah.
In the 2 to 20 megahertz
right.
range. And we knew that this system might very well not work if there were a serious amount of ionospheric molded path.
Right.
And Professor Fano, who was a colleague of Professor Davenport's, who had a sort of sister group, whereas we were doing secure or secret communications, Fano was doing secure radar, and so the two groups were not right next to each other, and Professor Fano suggested that I should try to attack the molded path communications problems from the point of view of statistical communication theory.
I see. This is all under the aegis of Lincoln Lab?
Well, it was, yes, just as Lincoln Lab was being formed, but it originally had started in the secret group of the Research Laboratory of Electronics.
Right.
Of which Jerry Wiesner was the associate director. And then that secret work was taken over in the Lincoln Laboratory and joined with the Air Force line item work on the SAGE system for which Lincoln Laboratory is really set up. But we were always sort of over in a corner of Lincoln Laboratory, not working on the main line,
right.
line item at all. We had our own source of support, in fact, from the Army rather than the Air Force.
Now, I'm drawing a blank as to what SAGE was.
The semi-automatic ground environment, the air plotting board, you might say automated plotting boards, idea for tracking aircraft by computer rather than by the manual techniques that had been used during World War II.
I see.
And for the defense of the continental
right.
United States.
Okay.
And the Korean War sort of motivated this
Okay, well, I just want to know roughly what it was.
It was, in a sense, a recreation of the old MIT radiation laboratory. Well, I worked for 3 years. I was at MIT for 3 years total. I graduated in September 1953. Am I speaking loud enough?
Oh, yes, this is fine. Yeah.
And my thesis was the first on the application of statistical communication hypothesis testing principles to create optimal ways of communicating over multipath. And originally it was going to be a secret thesis, but toward the end of it, it became apparent that it wouldn't have to be secret, which was good.
I was going to say, it is possible to have classified theses?
Or? In those days it was. I doubt that it is anymore.
Yeah, right.
But my close friend and colleague, Paul Green, who later worked mm-hmm. together on astronomical type things, his thesis indeed did stay secret.
Huh.
He created the pre-prototype of the first operational spread spectrum system, and it wasn't declassified for quite a few years.
Huh, interesting.
Yes, his diploma reads, for the title, it reads, Thesis Devoted to Classified Research. And I've had the pleasure recently of seeing him receive the Pioneer Award of the IEEE Aerospace Electronic Systems Society
uh-huh.
for this creation of the world's first operational spread spectrum system.
Well, when was it you came into contact with radar astronomy?
Well, I was thinking about what to do next, of course, after graduating,
yeah.
And the Fulbright, Senator Fulbright's idea of setting up fellowships
right.
for Americans to go abroad and for people abroad to come here, a marvelous opportunity, and I thought I would take advantage and not go to work right away, but to take a postdoctoral, essentially, by means of the Fulbright.
Right.
So I applied for a Fulbright, in due course was accepted. I had to postpone it because I didn't want to make the mistake of not completing my thesis before I left the country. I'd seen some friends of mine having problems like that, allowing gap in their career. But it was fine, I got to postpone it. And I had decided, I did the whole thing backwards, sort of. I decided I simply wanted to go to Australia because I couldn't be further from home in this case. It would be one chance to really see the Antipodes. And they spoke English.
Yes.
And those were really my only original reasons. So then I had to dig around and find out why I should
go to Australia.
You know, have a pretext for going to Australia for technological reasons. And then, and maybe I was aware of it before, I should have been, because the whole world knew about it really in the popular press. So I discovered that they were doing this radio astronomy.
Right.
And since it dealt with noise-like signals, mm-hmm. and I was trained in that field, there was at least I could convince the advisors
sure.
on the Fulbright program that there was a plausible thing to do there. So I went to Australia, and I went to buy boat all the way, as a matter
right.
of fact, across the Pacific, which was a great experience.
So you were there, which years in Australia?
So I arrived in the fall of 1953, and I was there until June of 54. And then I came back to the United States around the world by ship.
So you're just there 1 year, basically?
Only 9 months,
yeah.
really, but I was away a year. And when I came back, I went right back to Lincoln Laboratory. I was rehired. I wanted to go back.
Yeah.
But that's...
But I'd be interested in your impressions of what you saw when you got there. I mean,
yes.
And then we'll get to specifically what you did.
Right. Well, it was very quickly... Well, first I had to find a place to live, and the Wesley College on the grounds of the University of Sydney, which is where the
right.
radiophysics division was located on the same grounds in those days, although not part of the university, seemed like the best place to be. And fortunately,
mm-hmm.
the master of Wesley College, a Methodist college, a very internationalist looking outlook, and he always reserved rooms for people from abroad for various reasons that they might want to be resident there, whether they were no matter whether they were postdoctoral or undergraduate or whatever.
Right.
And so he fortunately had a room left, and I lived there the whole time, just had a short stroll over to the radiophysics division. And I was extremely cordially greeted by everyone. I sensed that Americans were well liked, and I was soon introduced to Taffy Bowen, Bowen, who was the head of the CSRO radio division, and then, of course, Dr. Pawsey.
Right.
And then they decided what where I might be able to help out, and I was then put under Gordon Stanley's direction to pursue search for the deuterium line, which had been predicted. Now, in those days, the hydrogen line 1420 was a very hot topic, and,
right.
And the people working very intensively on that. I remember a big parallel channel spectral analyzer that John
Murray,
that so-called Murray Bank location,
right.
Which was a real state-of-the-art thing to try to get the stability, both in amplitude and frequency, but I know that they finally succeeded there. And it was decided, I guess before, probably Gordon Stanley had already been starting on it before I arrived,
yep.
But it decided to use the Dover Heights area to look for this.
Right.
Using this dish fixed in the ground, which had been bootlegged, as I remember. In fact, things I say should be double-checked, because my memory isn't all that clear.
Sure.
But I think that there weren't the funds to build this dish, which was maybe 40 feet diameter.
Right.
And there just weren't the funds, so it had been vetoed. So the way they built it was to just start shoveling the sand themselves
right.
in odd hours till they got the thing
right.
built. And that was a minimum expense, but it was an important facility. And I guess it maybe it was spherical rather than parabolic. Anyhow,
the
scene could be moved, and they were carefully surveyed with the transit, the direction, the point, and so forth. And I remember Dick McGee used to set it up for us.
That's right.
And we made the observations. And many days of integration, and with the 4-minute sidereal time slippage, I forget which direction it is, that's how rusty I am on astronomy.
Earlier each day.
Yeah. So Gordon Stanley would come by with one of the CSIRO cars and pick me up in the wee hours of the night at the university, and we'd go out to make our observations. A couple of times we thought we might have had something significant, but when we averaged it all out, we had to say it was a negative result.
Were you just using a single channel?
A single channel sweeping through,
right.
Yes.
Right. And now you said that it had been predicted. Was this before the Russians made their claim of a detection? Did you start on this?
Gosh, I don't remember. I don't remember anything about a Russian claim.
I guess it must have been, actually, now that I think about it, because I think that theirs came out in 55, mm-hmm. their claim at a meeting at Jodl Bank, so you wouldn't have known about that at that time.
Yeah. No, I guess not. I know that when I got back to MIT, Sandy Weinrib had come up with an excellent idea of a digital correlator,
right.
hard limiter, and that he'd had a problem getting funding, and Jerry Wiesner asked me to write a letter to, maybe it was the National Science Foundation or something, vouching for my belief in his mm-hmm. technique, and in due course he did get funding,
uh-huh.
and then I think he looked for the line with a factor of 10 greater sensitivity and still wasn't there,
right.
So at that point he was beginning to get cosmologically significant.
Right.
Well, maybe we thought that we just had bad luck, we weren't pointing in the most probable direction.
Well, I forget where in fact were you looking, the Galactic
Center? Remember.
The abstract didn't say.
It's in Nature, doesn't
yeah.
it say?
And well, the abstract didn't say.
I even forget whether we're looking for an emission or absorption.
Probably absorption, but it didn't actually say where you were looking. I assume it was the Galactic Center. It goes right overhead.
That sounds sort of familiar.
In Sydney, yes. And it's a nice strong source.
Yes, that sounds that. Seems to me that probably was so.
But going back to when you got back to MIT, what term did you use for Sandy's autocorrelator scheme?
It was a one-bit correlator.
Yeah, but you said something about limiter. I didn't get that word.
Well, that's the same thing as saying it's one bit. It was just
I just hadn't heard that terminology.
Hard limiter.
Hard limited, I see.
Hard limited, that's an electrical engineer's terminology.
It means
just no. Polarity. It's a polarity right. correlator.
Okay. I can't think of the other term for it, but anyway, we both know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, down in Australia, I'd be interested in your impressions of the, I mean, you've been at MIT, which of course is always a leader in world's technology. Your impressions in both the way they did things and the kind of equipment they had at that time and so forth.
Well, I think that they maximized every potential that their equipment had. I wasn't particularly impressed with some of the components I saw. There was a crummy little variable capacitor made by Philips that sort of was a bunch of cylinders that could very easily short against each other, a mic kind of the variable capacity, picofarad. And that I felt negatively about that, but they had some fine general radio, probably pre-war instruments, frequency calibrators and so forth, that they had been taken good care of. And I was greatly impressed that the government of Australia would do this sort of thing in the first place to support basic science when it was inconceivable there'd be any practical application, but just on the merits. And also there was the desire to keep the excellent group together that had formed the Australian Radiation Laboratory.
Right, right.
And when they came up with this very good extension of their talents to this new area,
right.
And very, very sensible indeed, but just I have tremendous admiration, and I'm sure that Taffy Bowen must have had a great deal to do with proper, getting the government to create this division. So, I knew that they were unquestionably the world leaders. They were the only people in those days that I know. There's some work at NRL. I guess there was some.
Well, and Cambridge. We mustn't forget Cambridge. They were very.
That's true. I don't want to say it.
Very active. But Cambridge and Sydney were indeed the two world leaders at that time.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, sure, some of the surveys had already come out of Cambridge.
Right.
So please expurgate what I said. Yeah. Cambridge, that's ridiculous. But I was close in to the Australians.
Is it not fair to say probably that the budget per researcher was much lower than what would be typically at MIT? You talk about some of the components being old and...
I think getting instrumentation must have been pretty iffy, and they built an awful lot of the stuff themselves when they might have been able to buy it.
Yeah.
Might have been, I'm not sure, but I think so. And I have no idea what the salary levels were because I was on a fellowship, so
yeah.
I had no...
Well, they were undoubtedly much lower than the States also. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing, I was told that the appreciable fraction of that group, maybe 20 or 30%, were essentially card-carrying communists. To me as an individual, nobody could have been pleasanter. Say, Americans were liked whether it were communists or not. They were all very warm-hearted people.
Yeah.
I was interested in that, but I never engaged in any political discussions.
It wasn't your image of communists then?
I was told they were communists, but I guess really they were Marxists.
Yeah, right.
I know there's a difference.
Right. Any other impressions of the radio physics group?
There was this, they didn't have all that easy a time. There were some problems of support to the extent that some of them were forced into diversionary science, applied science, from time to time to do cloud seeding.
Yes.
And I really don't know whether that was too successful, but they all saw the need to keep the government's confidence,
right.
And since they potentially had the talent to do that kind of science too. They each, even John Bolton, would get up on the roof at Dover Heights sometime and set off some cloud seeding experiments. But I think it was just a case of playing the game. And if they made the effort, then they could really be allowed to continue in radio physics.
Sure,
That may be unfair to Taffy Bowen, I think. And he in particular had a genuine enthusiasm for cloud seeding.
Yes.
The others did not, but they played the game.
Yeah,
And so that was sort of interesting.
So you came back to MIT, and I guess you said Sandy Weinberg was just beginning, or did you have something?
Yeah, well, I wanted to mention, I shared an office for a while before I started working at Dover Heights with Gordon. Stanley, I shared an office with Chris and Bernie Mills and Ron Bracewell.
Oh, I see.
One corner of the office.
Good heavens. What a lively office.
Yes. And they had a large sheet of white paper, or maybe it was a white wall, on which they projected the sun through came in through the window.
I see.
Lens there, so that every day they could see just what the sunspots were telling.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that was a simple thing to do, with a very good idea. But I don't think I got into anything particularly technical with them. I was introduced to Bernie Mills's cross notion and the switching reverse phasing.
Right.
And that was the beginnings of aperture synthesis in Australia, at least.
Right.
There had been some, I was vaguely aware of some things that Ryle was doing in England, but this idea of the pencil beam of a low-gain, high-resolution antenna,
right.
that was very intriguing to me.
Yes.
But I never got into that kind of work, but at least I got to understand it. And when we did our deuterium line measurements, a lot of care was taken with optimizing the diode converter to try to get the lowest noise figure of each day. When we started out, we'd recalibrate both in frequency and in amplitude.
How many days did you go, roughly?
Oh, it was several months.
Oh, several months, actually.
Yes. Yeah, we didn't just add four or five runs together. We made dozens of runs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them maybe were ejected afterwards for some instability. The Dover Heights site was spectacular. You know, it was on top of, I guess, a 200-foot sandstone cliff, and I think by now it's all plunged into the sea. It was eroding away, being sandstone. And I think it had been a coast watch station during World War II.
Yeah, that's right.
And I worked in a trailer there. There was a main blockhouse, but we had a trailer beside the dish. And I remember,
this is a 17-foot dish, I think. It was the hole in the ground.
Yes. And also I remember that there was a sandwich shop, a little stroll down the street. We'd go ahead and get sort of a meal, and the proprietor was very upset that the Queen was coming. He felt he'd escaped from England to get away from the Queen, and this is the first royal tour.
Right.
So found that
amusing,
American
point of view.
Of course, I was taken around to see all the sites, even though I was only involved with one. I was given the grand tour, including Chris's set up at the Fleurs Reservoir, and down at
Potts Hill.
Potts Hill, was it?
Yeah, Fleurs is a separate site.
Was it Fleurs where the Mills Cross was
right.
built then? Oh, yes.
Right.
And down Dapto
right.
to see Paul Wilde's interferometers
right.
and spectral event measures and recorders. And Paul was a wonderful cook. I remember he cooked carpet bag steak stuffed with oysters. I've never had anything like that before. And that's what the sort of thing they sometimes did at the field site, with lots of beer to go with.
Right, right.
And I saw, I'm sure this is well documented, so there are gaps in my recollection of just what this was for, but there were different lengths of transmission line that would be put in at different times of the day on this interferometer.
Which one do you mean?
Well, there were three towers, each with a rotating arrangement, but then in addition, maybe there was phasing between them. I think the three towers covered three different frequency
yes,
ranges.
Yes, that's correct.
So I don't remember why the length of transmission lanes were put in and out, but it was all done automatically. Where built into it was a little hand-cranked German calculator the type that Steve Smurd used to use on his desk.
Right.
But this was actually built in, driven by a clock.
I see.
And it would, at the correct rate, switch in and out these lengths of transmission line, saving a great deal of human labor, but it must have been quite a job to engineer this thing in the first place to do this automatic.
This must have been a separate interferometer he had there besides the three rhombics, and it must have been a delay, you know, that he's switching in
to
track
it.
The sun.
Yeah, because I can't see what
but
the spectral analyzer it would be using.
Yeah.
Well, I know that it was Paul Wilde's genius to make this machine, but It's a long time ago. So
I'll have to check what other instrument they had there.
Yeah, that, I think that was a unique.
It probably was just a simple instrument to get a rough size on these bursts that they'd be measuring with the rhombics.
Wish I could recall what the application was. Well, but I do know that it switched in and out lots of lengths of transmission line.
Well, I could check
certain times of the day. And but anyway, depending on time of year, they would put in a factor that could run
as the sun went up and down in declination.
That's it, yeah.
Well, anyway, you were impressed by this great mechanical setup to do this.
And it wasn't all that expensive. I think this particular calculator was quite fancy. It was a $100 item, $125, I think I was told. But it was a unique solution to a problem that they had.
Right.
Essentially a digital, non-electronic calculator was being used there in an instrument. And there's sort of a bridge over into the secret communications work I was doing because Louis DeRosa of the ITT laboratories at Nutley, New Jersey, and also probably independently Jerry Wiesner of MIT, had come up with the idea that star noise could be used to make a secret carrier, a reference signal common to both the transmitter and receiver. I don't know how secret it would have been once the idea got out, because anybody else could put up a dish and get this noise from a particular direction.
Yeah.
But the fundamental problem was that if you wanted to go over intercontinental distances, there was no object small enough that would highly correlate at intercontinental distances. Jerry Wiesner, I think, told me that for cosmological reasons that there could never be an object in the sky smaller than a fraction of a second of arc. This is way before the quasars.
Was there any talk at all of the possibility of doing a VLBI experiment, as we would call it now, to actually try to see if there were any that small? Or?
No, because it was dogma that there wouldn't be anything that small.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was bound to secrecy, and the security wasn't lifted on the noise communication system for until about 1967, so I couldn't say anything to the Australians about it. And I certainly didn't go there to make that kind of a measurement. I was very pleased with the opportunity to look for a deuterium line. I was hoping we'd find it, but we didn't.
Well, it didn't get found, you probably know, until maybe 10 years ago, and I guess it is now, or 8 years ago.
Yes.
It's taken a long time, and then even now it's still not clear whether it's really there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well,
I wanted to ask whether that idea of using the cosmic noise as a carrier, was that before you went to Australia that came up? Or
yes.
Yeah, I say even before.
Yes, but really I went to Australia for the reasons I said, that it was far away, and
I just never
English,
heard of that.
And then I got acquainted with radio astronomy as the reason, because it was one of the two world centers to go to.
No, I've never heard of that idea. It's a fascinating idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, it couldn't be published because it was a secret idea. It only appeared. It has been published. It's now declassified work, but nobody. Well, we solved the problem by now of generating what we call pseudo noise at the remote site to correlate with the transmitted noise, and there's no need to consider the possible use of radio stars.
You had your common noise, like so you got back to MIT.
Yes, and then the system of secure communications, which is primarily for anti-jamming, and to this day the major use of spread spectrum noise-like carrier is for anti-jamming, had been going forward. Paul Green and I got our thesis, our SCDs, they gave SCDs, not PhDs at MIT, in electrical engineering. We both got it in the fall of 53, and he had stayed with the group, and he had an experimental success with the transmitter and receiver racks that he built for his thesis, and could run, could simulate an autonomous receiver long distance away, such that it appeared that it would be feasible to create this.
I see.
And so the efforts of the whole group swung over toward building a real prototype to be exercised transcontinentally between California and New Jersey. And it was successful as far as the basic idea went, but indeed Multipath did intrude and upset the correlation. Davenport was visited by a British team at one point while this was going on. They had secret need to know and so forth, and so Davenport could tell them everything he was doing. And they didn't make much comment about it, but it developed some years later that they independently had come up with the same notion. And we know of other companies, in fact, that had independently come up with the same notion. So the time was ripe for this secret use of these statistical communication concepts. They knew so much about the ionosphere that they decided they wouldn't build the system because the ionosphere would ruin them.
Mm-hmm.
But the British did, yes. They knew so much about the ionosphere. We didn't know that much about the ionosphere, so we were much more optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
But we did get into trouble, and we had to just buy something that would get us out of trouble. And working with Paul Green, I dug back into my thesis, which had been on multipath receiver synthesis of an optimum type, and we built a device called the Rake receiver, which used multiple correlators to coherently combine all the paths together, and that way we got our full, what we call, correlation processing gain against the jammer, and so that was successful,
mm-hmm.
and systems were manufactured for used by the U.S. Army all over the world, and were used to secure their international communications until satellites came in the mid-60s. So I was pleased that my thesis worked too, just as Paul's could be used mm-hmm. Led to an actual operational system. I also used this apparatus, the Rake system, to make measurements of the ionospheric behavior. And I published a couple of papers jointly with Paul in Nature
on the ionosphere,
measurements. And one of them showed how we could measure the differential Doppler among different paths. There was some scientific output.
But if we could move on to the radar astronomy.
Okay, well, I was involved in this communications group, but I had come back from Australia having worked in radio astronomy, and my interest in astronomy had sort of been kindled, you might say. And then sort of serendipity occurred. Millstone radar had been recently completed for operation, I think, 440 megahertz for observing missiles and satellites. And at the same time, Towns had invented the maser.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln Lab had an experimental model that they had verified the idea with, and it got a nice low noise temperature. I forget what it was, but it was a very conditionally stable type of gadget in a Dewar flask. And we put these two things together one day at lunch. I guess, having been for a little while in astronomy, I guess I knew something about Venus making a conjunction. And didn't happen very often, but 1958 would be an opportunity to try to go beyond the moon, because the moon, of course, had been observed by radar almost routinely, but nobody had gone beyond. And it seemed that if the albedo were high enough for Venus, I guess really unreasonably high, we had a chance of making an observation and getting a return after 5 minutes of integration, which was the round trip time out to Venus and back.
Right.
So this was.
So it was your suggestion initially.
Well, I don't recall all that much. I think Gordon Pettengill, Paul Green, and I were sitting around the lunch table, and I don't know how the subject came up, but Paul thinks it was I who said, "Oh, by the way, Venus is coming close." We were just talking about radar astronomy in general, and I happened to mention, "Oh, Venus is coming close."
There had been no lunar radar done at Lincoln Lab, had there?
No. Not that I can.
Not that I know of either.
Uh-huh. So back of envelope calculation indicated that it would be a fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It was an ALADS mount, so I had to work up an ephemeris,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the Nautical Almanac to do that. I had to do a lot of interpolation But we got a computer program going to print out reams and reams of pointing angles as a function of time of day. And also the distance at every time, because we had to phase our transmission in accordance with the distance we had to... had something to do with turning it on and turning it off. I'm not quite sure why distance was so important to us, but we certainly had no Doppler.
Yes.
So we had, the ephemeris included the predicted Doppler at 440 megahertz so that we could keep our filters tuned, and we had a frequency synthesizer to do that. We would keep changing dials on the synthesizer.
Was the dish computer controlled, or were you manually changing it every
The dish
so
had
often?
Had a rate control. I think when the operator would sit there and modify the rate
slightly. Oh, yes. Okay.
So,
but still, I imagine that the computer technology you had was really quite advanced to what the average astronomical observatory would have at that time.
I guess it was.
Being Lincoln Lab.
We did something that I think was quite new, and that was to acquire the data digitally. We had an A to D converter, the Datrack, which I think was capable of up to 20 kilosamples a second. And we maybe had 6-bit accuracy, so we froze the data onto a Potter tape recorder, which was a digital tape recorder, and it was, we only got, I think, 4 valid observations out of many tries because of problems with the tape recorder.
Well, it says in the abstract that you got 2 out of 4 tries.
Is that so? The other
well, 2 out of 4 showed positive evidence.
That's right. Two out of 4 showed positive evidence, but I think we had tried to get more than 4 total, but only ended up with 4 that we considered valid.
Right.
We were very pleased to have them there for very intensive non-real-time analysis, and so I think that was the first type of experiment that had been done where digital data collection was done.
Yeah, I think that may be right.
And then Roland Silver taught me Fortran so that I could build the radiometer, the optimum matched radiometer, to process the data. And we did it on the 704 computer, and building all the Doppler filters properly and so forth. And we also transmitted one of our secret type modulations, pseudo-noise modulation, so that we get an unambiguous range to Venus. We transmitted one cycle of what's called a maximal length shift register sequence, which is a pseudo-noise sequence. There was nothing secret about this experiment. We just happened to have that element of commonality with our secret work in communications, because that made a nice unambiguous transmission. We modulated 2 ways, both on-off and also in phase flipping. But the latter was not considered really to be really stable enough, and we stayed mainly with the on-off. The data that we presented in Nature was based on the on-off transmissions.
Or in science.
Science, I'm sorry.
Right.
Science.
Now, one question I had was that two different abstracts that I had gave somewhat conflicting evidence as to the power. Can you tell me what your peak power was? Was it more like 0.3 or 3 megawatts?
I think it was 3 megawatts. I think it was the order of hundreds of kilowatts.
Yeah, so 0.3.
Out of a klystron. No, I don't think it was 3
megawatts. Okay, well, one said one, one said the other.
I think that's a slip decimal point, probably.
Okay, so. And that would be peak.
Yes.
And 2 millisecond pulses. And the pulse rate was what, roughly? I can check the article, but it didn't. I was just curious.
I think we got 8,000 pulses out in a space of 5 minutes.
Which is 600 seconds, so that's about 100 per second.
Well, whatever that works
out. So that's about a 20% duty cycle. It makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, our duty cycle was, I don't think it was as high as 20% even, but maybe it was.
Well, were there any problems with the transmitter, or was this just a standard transmitter that had been used for...
No, it wasn't too standard. It had a, I remember now, we had a Varian klystron, and just as we were about to go on the air, the thing had burnt out, and we had a rush delivery from the West Coast for another one. After working for several weeks to get everything set up, as I say, this is really a bootlegged experiment. We worked all odd hours to rush the thing into place.
So your dinner or lunchtime conversation was only a couple months before this was going to happen.
Yeah, not much time. And then we thought we were going to be ruined at the end because the Klystron burned out and the other one might not arrive in time. But it did arrive in time. It was a bit of a problem getting it tweaked up, but it did last. We were afraid that the experiment might burn it out, but it did last. It was a bit temperamental. The experiment was done without any comment from the management. To my knowledge, they neither blessed nor damned it. They just turned their backs and let us do our stuff.
Right. It was very different from anything that was going on.
There wasn't any military motivation, of course. I think they were just as curious as we were as to whether we'd get an echo. And it could be factored into their general research program, but I don't think there wasn't any project organization. It was just a bunch of buddies working together as equals, all trying to make each person's part of the system work together.
Right. Well, could you tell me what the different people primarily worked on? I have about six or seven people on this science article.
Yeah. Is Carl Blake's name there?
No.
Robert Kingston.
Kingston.
Yes, Kingston was in charge of the Maser, and Carl Blake was the person who actually sat there with this Dewar bottle and tried to keep the thing
nursed
stable.
And Goblick?
I'm embarrassed to say. I mean, at the time, everybody, we thought carefully about the selection of names, but I can't recall now. I remember, as I say, Roland Silver taught me Fortran and watched over my shoulders.
Right.
Processing. And his name is there.
Yes, yeah. Silver. Kraft?
Jake Kraft was, I think, on the site there at Millstone. He was a group leader, but I can't remember his specific role.
Pettengill?
Well, Pettengill was much more knowledgeable of astronomy than I was, and he may remember also the other...
Yeah, well, I have undoubtedly asked him this also, but...
And I think Paul Green also, if you could talk to him, could...
I haven't talked to yet.
There. He's at IBM Armonk Labs, by the way.
Armonk.
He's easily reachable on the phone, and he can correct some goofs that I may well make here.
That's in the town of Armonk?
A-R-M-O-N-K in New York State.
In New York,
IBM headquarters.
And Smith?
Oh, yes. Bill Smith was responsible for being able to acquire the data digitally. He struggled with the Potter tape recorder, which was very temperamental, and the analog to digital conversion and the interface. And in the great pressure of time, he got the bugs out of it.
Right.
And later on, he went on to a very significant scientific discovery on his own, which I want to come to.
Mention later, okay. Did you know about the efforts that were going on at Jodrell Bank and in the Soviet Union at the same conjunction?
I knew Kotelnik. Paul Green was very familiar with the Russians, and I think he had a personal rapport with Kotelnikov. I knew that soon afterwards, at least, the Russians were doing this, and it was, in fact, a leading man in statistical communication theory on the Russian side, Kotelnikov, who even before World War II had, in his thesis, published some important things that Shannon did independently later. And he got himself, he's an academician, member of the Academy of Russia. And
he's a vice president of the Academy now, actually.
Right, but from early on, he was an academician. And somehow he got himself interested in radar astronomy. I don't know why that was. So he became, I think, the leader of that Russian effort.
Right. What about the Jodrell group? Did you know?
The Jodrell? We tried a bistatic experiment with Jodrell, so there was really an element of cooperation.
On this conjunction?
Well, no, maybe it was 1959.
We
tried both in 58 and 59.
Right, right.
So maybe in 58, we didn't have the contact. John Evans will remember.
Yeah, well, I have talked to him several years ago.
I guess we got to know each other through the contemplated joint bistatic experiment
right.
in 59.
Right. So when you were doing this, you didn't know about the other groups doing anything. Wasn't any great competition motive.
I'm afraid I don't remember.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer.
Or maybe I didn't count. Maybe.